Greetings and salutation, friends, and welcome back to The Arcade for the first show of 2017. How's it going, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, children of all ages? I am Mike the Legend, who's glad to be back with you in the new year. Glad that you can be back with us once again. Hopefully everyone has survived the holiday season and survived the first couple days of 2017. This being a year that has not claimed any celebrities just yet. So thank you for joining us on this edition of The Arcade, a special episode where we take a look back at the year of 2016. Part one, actually, of our look back at the year that was, where we focus on the bigger stories of 2016.
Yes, and this week, this year, this first show, I am Dennis, the man who never thought he would enjoy driving around as a boy band as much as he is.
Are you driving around 98 Degrees, NSYNC, Backstreet Boys?
No, I'm playing Final Fantasy 15.
Oh! I see what you did there.
I can see how the mistake could be made, but no.
Understandable.
I did not pick up chauffeur gig on the side driving around, you know, guys from the 90s. No. I'm playing Final Fantasy 15, which I just figured that was a funny way to describe the game, which in a weird way, it's sort of accurate.
Mm-hmm.
But in another weird way, it's a weird game. It's a very weird game.
It has an aesthetic that makes it look rather different than previous Final Fantasy games.
But it still feels like a Final Fantasy game, and I'm enjoying it I'm enjoying it almost as much as I think I enjoyed Final Fantasy XII when I played it for the first time. Which is quite a lot.
Interesting.
I was ready to give up on Final Fantasy after that. All of those Final Fantasy XIII games were just, I slogged my way through Final Fantasy XIII. And foolishly picked up Final Fantasy 13 2, and then wrote the whole series off after playing that game for like 5 hours. I was just like, okay, I'm done with this.
Really?
And then heard a lot of crazy things about 15, saw the aesthetic, and was just like, okay, fine. And now I've been playing it. I've put about 16 hours in, and I'm really enjoying it.
It, from what I've seen so far, the setting at least looks very different compared to previous Final Fantasy games, especially in the start, where you're, say, in Hammerhead, getting to Hammerhead and whatnot, where it's not medieval fantasy, futuristic fantasy type realm.
Yeah, it's not cyberpunk, it's not steampunk, it's just basically now.
Yeah.
There's no weird mysterious technology. I mean, there is, like, from here and there, there's like weird imperial technology that slips in and stuff, but it's sort of treated like it's like this weird super futuristic force that's just sort of trying to take over. But that's sort of an underlying thing that I haven't really got into yet. I don't really know about. I don't care about spoilers. I mean, I don't want to look into spoilers because I'm playing the game, but yeah, just from the driving around that I've been doing, which there's a lot of it. Like most of the game is just driving from point A to point B.
Mm-hmm.
Hanging out with your bros in the car and listening to whatever music, which, by the way, is also a lot of old Final Fantasy soundtracks, which I definitely enjoyed. But,
You're driving around in cars.
Yeah, cars that don't look like weird, futuristic, weird cars or like science fiction cars. No, they look like real cars. Some of them look like they're from like the 60s. Some of them look like they're maybe more modern. But yeah, they're all real looking cars.
Like modern, you know, supercars even.
Some of them, yeah. Like your car is like a sports car kind of thing, but.
Which makes sense. You are the prince.
Yeah, it's like a luxury sports car. You're the prince of whatever, the land or whatever it is. But yeah, there's like lots of sedans and hatchbacks and stuff that you see, trucks. It's a very
weird.
It's very weird. You have to refuel your car at like refueling stations and stuff. Then you see like power lines along the sides of roads and yeah, it's very strange, but I'm enjoying it quite a bit. There's, you know, just some unexplainable. It has that unexplainable thing about certain classic Final Fantasy games that you don't know why you enjoy them.
Mm-hmm.
At least I don't know specifically why I enjoy them. I just like something about the overall aesthetic I like. Final Fantasy IV had it. Final Fantasy VI had it. VII had it in spades. I mean, 8 and 9 both had it. 10 was kind of there. 12 had it. 13 didn't really have it. But 15 definitely has it, I think.
And it seems to certainly put a heavy focus on the four main characters that you deal with.
Yeah.
It's you're not necessarily... You're not necessarily an individual who goes around and then acquires people and brings them into your party. You seem to start off with the party.
Yeah. It's very classic Final Fantasy in that sense, where the party's this. The party doesn't expand. The party doesn't get smaller. You don't have people swapping in and out. Mm-hmm. That's just it. And they did a very interesting thing story-wise, I think, that I'll... You know, I admit was, I didn't really know about, but apparently with that movie, that Kingsglaive that came out, it apparently gives you a whole ton of backstory and a lot of the political ins and outs and stuff. But it sounds like, it seems like it's a good idea to watch that after you've played the game. Because the way that the game sort of works is it sort of just throws you in. It doesn't really give you any context of what's going on, which is actually fine, because as the prince, you're sort of like in your own world with your own friends, like you're just a kid and you don't really know what's going on, so it's fine. You have the same level of knowledge as your characters are supposed to have, which is kind of odd that, you know, a lot of games don't really do that.
And that they almost give too much information.
Yeah, they'll give you the whole, they'll build the whole world and show cutscenes from across the ocean and do a, this is the guy here. It's like for some reason we get to see into this strategy meeting between these high ups here and there. And, but if you're just like playing as like some street urchin kid or something, like this kid doesn't know about the rest of the world. He doesn't care. He's just going to walk around. Like, why aren't there more games that just do that? Like give you just the specific perspective and then your perspective gets, expanded as you expand it through natural means by going around and finding stuff out, overhearing conversations,
meeting new people.
Yeah. Like it's kind of refreshing that that's how this game is as opposed to just giving you weird cutaways every now and then for no reason.
Well, also in this regard, the game's not really holding your hand as much either.
Yeah.
By giving you all the details, all the information right off the hop and just kind of telling you what you need to know as you progress.
Yeah, so I admit that there was a couple of cutscenes, now I think about it, that they show you sort of like the bad guys, but I'm okay with that just so you can sort of like just get a taste for like who these bad guys are eventually going to be when you meet up with them. But they don't show you much more than just like who the bad guys are and that they have like evil accents kind of thing and they're not afraid to.
Of course they have accents.
Yeah.
That's how you know they're the bad guys. If there was any doubt.
Yes, but yeah, basically so far enjoying Final Fantasy 15.
Excellent. Well,
maybe by next week, that'll change, but hopefully not.
It's that 25th hour. Just whew. Burdensome, just puts everyone to the test. It's a Widowmaker.
Yes.
That 25th hour in Final Fantasy, if you've muscled through it, let us know. And also what you were playing over the holidays, send us an email, info@thearcadeshow.com. Or hit us up on Twitter. We are @TheArcadeShow. And on Facebook, facebook.com/TheArcadeShow. And as I said off the top of this program, it is part one of our look back at the year 2016. This week, as is traditional with our year in review shows, we look back at the bigger stories that came out in the world of video games the year prior. And we've kind of narrowed things down to about five key core topics that we're going to talk about through the course of this program. But to us, the top kind of news item news maker really of the year of 2016 was Nintendo.
Yeah, for better or for worse, they were the ones that sort of made the most consistent, maybe not the biggest waves, but the most consistent waves throughout the whole year, I think.
Which is kind of weird, considering they didn't really have a new piece of hardware come out. Their major software releases were few and far between, yet they still managed to get themselves out there and make noteworthy headlines on a regular enough basis for us to deem them, for the second year in a row, Newsmaker of the Year. And we started talking about them back in February, actually, once during an investors Q&A when Tatsumi Kimishima, the still relatively new president of Nintendo, just kind of really started to downplay the whole quality of life product segment that we were looking forward to, had expected. But
yeah, I think looking forward to is a little bit strong of words. We're expecting it, I think.
Yes.
So really, I think the biggest, it's sort of less specific to this product, but I think it's a more general thing that we saw. Like, as Kimishima came in as president, we sort of saw him really putting his own stamp on how, in his vision for Nintendo, I think, which is less of expanding around and trying to do more things like Mr. Iwata was trying to do, and bringing the focus back strictly to games.
Yes, and certainly the quality of life products, while they may have been, you know, some interesting ideas and technologies in there, they would not have necessarily served Nintendo's core game products, be they hardware or software.
Yeah.
And Satoru Iwata, even when he announced them, said that he envisioned them as being a third pillar, along with hardware, along with software, of the Nintendo business strategy.
Yes, but I guess Kimishima, while he, in his investors conference speech that he was, or his big presentation he was giving for the investors, while he didn't specifically say that it was dead, he kind of tempered expectations and maybe wasn't so keen on the three legs approach of Nintendo, and maybe decided all they need is the two legs.
Likely, because
easier to shop for pants, perhaps.
Yes, otherwise you're just looking for stool coverings, if you will.
Yes.
Stool leg coverings.
Yes.
But
we'll go with that. It's a little bit more family friendly of an image.
Yes, we'll go with that. Stools. Stools have three legs.
Yes.
Yep.
Tripods.
Certainly for cameras.
Yes.
Photography. But we kind of saw one of the other big stories of 2016 intertwine, and we'll talk more specifically about it in a couple minutes. Pokemon was arguably the franchise of 2016, and we learned back in February just what those next main Pokemon games were.
Yeah.
When Nintendo announced, somewhat out of the blue, yet still tying in with the fact that 2016 was the 20th anniversary of the original Pokemon games, and man, what a 20th anniversary year Pokemon had as a franchise.
Oh yeah.
But we learned that there were going to be new mainline core Pokemon games coming out later in the year, those announced in February as being Pokemon Sun and Moon. And as I said then, and I will maintain now, those are some of the, you know, I'm impressed that that's, you know, the pairing of, you know, titles they had for that, Sun and Moon, as all Pokemon games come out in twos. There is some sort of tie-in interplay between the titles, Red and Blue, Gold and Silver.
X and Y.
X and Y. And, you know, I've openly wondered on the show before, what other twin pairing type name could they find? And Sun and Moon works really well.
Yeah.
I did not see that coming, but that was just the announcement. But there was another tenant to Nintendo's software approach this year that we certainly have to talk about, which was the smartphone gaming.
Yeah. In many ways, Nintendo sort of fully arrived in that market. Some people thought it was through Pokemon Go, but in a way, Pokemon Go did set the seeds properly in people's minds for Nintendo to be on smartphones, even if Pokemon Go wasn't actually a Nintendo initiative. They had their hand in it as much as they have their hand in any Pokemon thing, which is just sort of as like a, I want to say silent partner.
I think so. I mean, they're a one-third owner in the Pokemon franchise.
Yeah, but it's not by any means, they're not by any means a majority
no
voice in the Pokemon world. So yeah, but Pokemon Go sort of set quite a good stage for Nintendo's name out there on the smartphones, as well as when they launched Miitomo.
Indeed, which was them dipping their toe into the world of smartphone games, it being the first of the five smartphone games to come out in the partnership between Nintendo and DNA, which was announced back in 2015. Miitomo coming out on March 31st, and hit with a kind of relative shrug emoji?
Yeah.
Is that the best way to describe it? I mean, it came out, it was kind of a thing. A lot of people explored it to find out what it is. Oh, it's this thing. Okay, you make... It's an extension of the Miis that we see on the Nintendo Wii and Wii U.
Yeah, the game in a nutshell is you make a Mii, you basically add your friends from Facebook, and then you answer a bunch of questions, either that the app asks you or your friends ask you when they drop in mm-hmm. randomly. And then you can also change your Mii's clothes, buy outfits, do whatever. That's the whole game.
There is little depth to it.
No. It's literally just an experiment on the smartphones for Nintendo to sort of get themselves out there. And I feel like it worked a little bit.
If that was the intent, just to kind of get it out there and test the waters, see what it's all about, more or less a test drive of the smartphone game market, sure.
Yeah.
And then take the experiences, go forward, and also maybe create somewhat of an install base for people's Miis and a universe for Miis on smartphone devices that they can utilize and better expand upon in later smartphone game releases. But as we said at the start of 2016, the year would certainly be one that really sets up Nintendo as they really reposition themselves for the future.
Yeah, reposition and refocus themselves more as an overall game company that tries to be a little bit more pervasive in how they are a game company rather than just a game company that also does other stuff. Mm-hmm. They want to be a game company, period, again.
They do, and at the same time, actually, that Nintendo announced their partnership with DNA for smartphone gaming back in early 2015, alongside that big surprise, Satoru Iwata at the time also announced that they were working on a brand new piece of hardware, which at the time they had simply, and up until October of last year, had called the NX. And a lot of us had expected to see what the NX would be, find out what it would be about, so what opportunities it presented the gaming public. But we were surprised at the end of April when Nintendo announced that it would not, in fact, be at E3 in any capacity. And furthermore, Nintendo announced that their plans for E3 were solely focused on the new Legend of Zelda game.
Yeah, so I mean, they would be at E3, but not to show off any sort of system whatsoever.
No, I mean, their booth would solely be dedicated to the new Legend of Zelda title. That would be the only thing they'd have on for play, or demonstration for play. And
yeah, and before E3 happened, we sort of were wondering, like, and a little bit skeptical of this move. Like, we thought, is this a smart idea on Nintendo's part? Is one game going to be enough to kind of give them any sort of presence and headspace in E3's news cycle at all?
It's a hell of a gamble that they were taking. And if the new Legend of Zelda game was not well received, whew, that's certainly would blow up in their face, and the news cycle, the discussion of Nintendo at E3 would be, wow, they blew it, versus everyone looking and paying attention to the new Legend of Zelda game, or that would be further to the discussion of Nintendo blowing it, because the new Legend of Zelda would be crap, potentially.
Yep.
By placing all their eggs in the one Legend of Zelda basket.
Yes.
We haven't really seen a company do that before.
No. And luckily for Nintendo, the gamble paid off. because they sort of won E3.
I think it paid off perhaps even better than they could have imagined.
Yeah, like I don't think there was another singular thing that had as much buzz as Breath of the Wild did for E3. I mean, other companies certainly, I mean, Sony had a good show,
mm-hmm.
Microsoft had a good show, but these were entire companies with entire rosters of games putting on...
With multiple products.
Yeah,
with
multiple things going on. It wasn't just a single thing resting on its own sort of, own weight, really.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas Nintendo, with just their one booth, with several PlayStation, with kiosks, PlayStations would have also worked, but not, I can't say that because that's not,
would have meant
something else in this context, but play kiosk set up, with huge lines, the biggest lines that all the photos suggested of all of the whole E3 experience this year. People were waiting for hours to play this game.
And I think another fact that impressed me of Nintendo at E3, aside from dedicating, and the gumption it took to dedicate everything, their booth presence, which is not insignificant, the amount of space these large companies have at E3.
No, they have a huge amount of space, and for Nintendo to take it all up with Zelda was quite a gamble.
It's quite a gamble, but not only that, they broke with what we traditionally see in E3 booth spaces, where it's a lot of just play kiosks, demo stations or what have you, and just, you know, visual banners and other stuff for games and properties being shown on the show floor by those companies. But Nintendo took their booth and used it as an opportunity to really try and immerse the attendees in a Legend of Zelda experience. They had different carpet. They made it almost like an immersive experience that you would see at Disney World or a theme park.
Yeah.
They really themed their booth space with plastic figures, the goblins that you see in the demos, towers to bring that Legend of Zelda game world to life for the attendees,
yeah.
Which was another big talking point of people at the show.
Again, even the queuing space for the line was, from what it looked like, almost like some sort of castle, like hallway type experience kind of thing that you would walk through.
Yes.
So everything about it was almost like you're like Hyrule Castle. You get to see almost like a museum of like the world of Hyrule, which, as you know, is the whole world that all the Zelda games take place in.
Which is true. And, it was, I mean, that's an expensive proposition for Nintendo as well, to have the, you know, stage dressing, the set dressing, if you will, for their booth space. And I mean, they didn't really skimp. They didn't really go cheap on it because everything looked very well done. And again, if that went south, that's going to look really bad. And also it's a lot of time, energy and effort just right down the crapper.
Oh yeah.
You're not getting back, but thankfully for Nintendo, it turns out Breath of the Wild was widely received because this is a take on Zelda we've never seen before.
Yeah. And, the buzz, it's died down a little bit now, but I'm sure that'll change once they release something else.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, they really got people going with this. And I think that's another thing that really happened quite a lot with Nintendo with this past year, was that they sort of realized, wait, we know exactly what we have in terms of a history and what we can exploit as well. Zelda is definitely a part of that history.
Mm-hmm.
And when you do, I mean, you have to do it right, but if you do it right, you're going to knock it out of the park.
Mm-hmm.
And another thing that happened sort of after E3 and after a little bit of the buzz had died down, they wanted to keep the hype train going. So in July, they announced something else that had people going crazy over.
They did. Out of nowhere, there were not even rumblings, rumors, scuttlebutts, no smoke pointing to a fire. This literally came out of left field for people, but the announcement by Nintendo of the NES Classic Edition, more affectionately called the Mini NES.
Yeah.
And that's exactly what it is. It is a scaled down version, replica of the Nintendo Entertainment System that comes pre-bundled with 30 games. Most of them are classic to the system. Others are Galaga, Pac-Man, Radius.
Yeah, other more general
bubble bobble
games, but
you don't necessarily think of being system defining games, but yet at the same time, the mini NES, the NES Classic Edition, you know, did come pre-bundled with all three Super Mario Brothers, Final Fantasy, Ice Climber, Metroid, Donkey Kong, both Legend of Zeldas.
Yeah.
So, Star Tropics, and whatnot, Castlevania 1 and 2.
Yeah.
So, Kid Icarus even, and which, I mean, Nintendo knows they have a lot of built up, nostalgia cachet.
Yeah, and that's sort of what Nintendo has over the other game companies still. So even if their systems aren't going to be as powerful as the other systems, or even if they don't have the most, you know, hardcore AAA new tech mm-hmm. available to them, they're still going to do fine because they have all that built up cred over the last 30 years.
With multiple generations of gamers now.
Yeah.
2 to 3 generations of gamers who have grown up with Nintendo and Nintendo games and Nintendo characters being a part of their lives and their gaming experience. And while other companies, as you rightly said, can have better tech, I mean, those companies, PlayStation 4 and an Xbox One, those can win your eyeballs. Nintendo can win your heart. And that's certainly what the NES Classic Edition did, ultimately releasing in November, on November 11th, to limited supply that also keeps the demand up for the system.
Yeah, which is a little bit frustrating. I mean, I still want to get one, but I'm probably out of luck for a while yet,
because mm-hmm.
I'm not willing to wait in line, and I'm not also willing to spend over $300 for one. So,
true enough, if you were fortunate enough to get one, then no doubt you've been enjoying it. I, thankfully, had people get one for me.
Yes.
Because my birthday was around that time, so they owed me. I kind of, you know, just kind of browbeat them into it. And it worked out.
Yes. But speaking of the, you know, winning people over with nostalgia, getting into their hearts, something else that happened in September with Nintendo was, I think, another major thing that they did, which sort of also extended out their toe a little bit more into maybe the full foot, or maybe even almost a whole leg into the smartphone market.
I'd say it was ankle plus.
Yeah.
Of what they dipped in.
Which is when Shigeru Miyamoto made a surprise appearance at, well, the Apple event that happened back in September.
Mm-hmm.
Which is when he completely, no one was expecting it. People were kind of like completely confused when they saw him on stage. Like, what the hell is Shigeru Miyamoto doing on stage at the Apple event?
Mm-hmm.
And he basically revealed Super Mario Run, which is still an iOS exclusive game. It was for quite a while.
It came out in December, was announced at the time, and as being iOS timed exclusive.
Timed exclusive.
The registration for Super Mario Run on Android has now opened, but there's still no firm release date announced for it yet. I'm sure that's part and parcel of why Shigeru Miyamoto was at the Apple event.
Oh, of course.
But I mean, that's a huge stage and a huge platform for Nintendo to, you know, share the stage or be given stage space and time by Apple.
Yeah.
To announce, Super Mario Run. If you haven't picked it up yet because you have an Android device, it's a continuous runner with Mario, running through traditional Mario stages, offers a couple levels for free, but if you want the full experience with three different game modes, that's going to cost you $10 to $15.
Yeah. So that was sort of, really, I think when Nintendo decided, okay, well, maybe not, they obviously decided it beforehand, but I think in many people's minds, that was probably the first real Nintendo game on a smartphone device.
Mm-hmm.
Because, I mean, Pokemon Go, it later, like, people found out that, no, Nintendo wasn't really involved in this.
Mm-hmm.
And then things happened, stock prices fell, but then...
We'll talk more about that in a couple minutes.
Yeah, but Miitomo, while it did have 10 million downloads, I don't know if people necessarily kept with it for that long.
Miitomo certainly seems like it had a higher, I guess, burn rate. Where people would download it, try it, and then be done with it very quickly.
But, yeah.
And that's because it was, I mean, it's a franchise that doesn't necessarily have the built-in cachet, name brand value that a Super Mario does.
Yeah.
I mean, if Nintendo really wants to go hardcore into smartphone gaming, they've got the franchises and characters that they could really do a lot of stuff with. You know, like a Donkey Kong, a Star Fox, or whatever. Hell, even, as I've said before, do an Endless Runner Ice Climbers game.
Yeah, an Endless Jumper.
Endless Jumper type game with Ice Climbers. They have properties that people know and like already. So how do they translate that? But Super Mario, their biggest bullet to date, and arguably their biggest bullet they could potentially fire at smartphone gaming.
Yeah.
That being the second of their five smartphone games that they'll do with DNA. They've also announced that there's going to be a Fire Emblem game based on that RPG franchise, and also an Animal Crossing one.
Yes, which I'm most excited about.
Which Animal Crossing really seems like a franchise that would work well as a smartphone game.
Oh, I think so. And I can't wait to see what happens with it, but either way, that's for 2017, and that's not 2016 news.
Yeah,
but
that's true. Ultimately, Super Mario Run, very successful, you know, quickly got to 50 million downloads within, I believe, the first week of its release.
Yeah, not gonna lie, still waiting for that. We'll probably pick it up and pay money, buy the full thing when it comes out for Android, because it looks good, and I wouldn't mind a good Endless Runner
that
makes sense on my phone.
And so there's still some, good smartphone games yet to come from Nintendo, but given that we were surprised by Nintendo's declaration of what we wouldn't see at E3 with the NX, and what they showed of Breath of the Wild at E3 was running on the Wii U, there was kind of a void, a vacuum, a certain lack of information about what the NX would be. And it happened a couple times in 2016 where there'd be drips and drabs coming out of what the system would be. And we heard back in the summertime reports coming from Eurogamer of what the system might be. It might be a handheld, or likely would be a handheld device with detachable controllers and that kind of stuff. And lo and behold, all the drips, all the drabs, all the leaks, all the rumors and the scuttlebutt we heard about the NX actually turned out to be completely correct.
Yeah.
This is one of the other big surprises of 2016.
Yeah, it was one of those things where people had a bunch of what sounded to be crazy sounding rumors about like all these insane things that like the Nintendo NX could be. Mm-hmm. Like, oh, it might be a thing where you could like seamlessly take it from one screen to another and keep playing a game. Mm-hmm. It might be a thing where, you could play full, console quality games, portably with multiple people off of the same portable kind of system kind of thing. But it might be a tablet kind of thing that docks. It might be something with controllers that are convertible type controllers that could be different types of controller. Mm-hmm. All of these things proved to be true.
Mm-hmm.
It was one of those weird things where, I don't want to say it lived up to the hype because we don't know that just yet.
No.
A hype train could be a dangerous thing, which we will get to
later on
in this show when we talk about something else that happened this year, but not Nintendo. But It's a strange case where it looks like it may be delivering on all of the things that people had as wishful thinking. Like, I don't want to say these are, a lot of them did seem like wishful thinking. Like, there's usually an element of that with a rumor.
Mm-hmm. And also, you have to take the sources into consideration. Do these people perhaps have an agenda? Do they have some sort of other ulterior motive in trying to get this information out there? I don't really care right now because everything was proven to be correct in the really short video, only 3.5 minute video that Nintendo released. And that's all we have thus far of what the NX will be.
It was a typical sizzle reel type video, the kind of thing where you see the smiling model people, the people who are obviously paid models in like the nicely done up living room playing, perfectly staged, game that looks perfect on their big crazy TV, eating the popcorn and the, whatever, we've all seen those sizzle videos a million times.
But this typical sizzle video was atypical for Nintendo.
Yes, because it had a couple of very weird things. The most notable of which was there were no families.
Nope.
There was no families sitting around, like there wasn't grandpa and, you know, grandma sitting around with the grandkids trying to play a bowling game. There mm-hmm. was no mom and dad just laughing with the kids as they're playing some sort of Mario Party game. And there wasn't like, you know, big brother playing a racing game as the sister comes in trying to play her horse racing. No, nothing like that. There was no families. It was all like young professionals.
25 to 35 year olds.
Like older millennials. Professional people, like the biggest portion of the controller was dedicated to a guy who was nudged by his wife, girlfriend, whatever, to go take their dog out.
Yes.
Because he was sitting on the couch playing a game. So the thing was he took the game, he, you know, undocked the system, basically took the game in its tablet form out as he walked the dog.
Mm-hmm.
And then took the dog to the dog park and was kind of playing the game.
And granted, he's completely ignoring his dog.
Yeah. And it looks like it's like 5 a.m, so whatever, it's fine. Ish. But that was the main selling action, the main scenario that they had.
Yeah. The main demographic, certainly. If you compare the, one of the Wii hype videos or even commercials for the Wii, 10 years ago to what we saw released by Nintendo in October showing off the now named Nintendo Switch, you will see the contrast between the two of them.
Oh yeah.
It is not trying to position the Switch as a family game device. It is trying to position it as cool gaming tech that the older millennial 25 to 35 young professional demographic, those with an interest in technology, new technology, and those with disposable income will be interested in.
And perhaps those that grew up playing Nintendo products.
Mm-hmm.
So.
And the video actually showed off a couple of different scenarios that really showed some of the diversity that this Switch has.
Or could have.
I think. Yes. And ultimately execution remains to be seen because the machine has not yet been released, but it shows people, as you said, sitting on the couch playing a game, then attaching the controllers, what are called Joy-Cons.
Yeah.
Whatever. Hate that name. Stupid. To the sides and then walking away with it and continuing their gaming experience without missing a beat whatsoever. Showing people just on a plane, which I love that scene because I do a crap ton of traveling on planes.
That is your life.
It is my life. And the tablet portion, you know, has a kickstand built in. So you just prop it up on your tray table and detach the Joy-Cons and boom, you're just playing right there. A full console gaming experience.
Yes.
On a plane. Amazing. Or even the random rooftop party that happened. That yes. Apparently happens to the older millennial demographic, just random rooftop parties. So the girl in the video brought the Switch and there was a big party and people playing multiplayer because those Joy-Cons can be individual controllers for separate players.
Yes, exactly.
Or even we also saw
the sports team where they saw
the basketball court.
Yeah, where they had three or four of these Switches just in close proximity to each other,
mm-hmm.
and each one was sort of networked with each other, and they were all sort of playing like a massive multiplayer type game.
Mm-hmm.
It was like a soccer game or something that they were
a basketball. NBA 2K17 was shown in the game, though it's not officially announced. Was it Elder Scrolls? Was it Skyrim?
Yeah, it showed someone playing a copy of Skyrim as well, which also Bethesda went on record saying, there's no confirmed reports that Skyrim is going to be on this system, except for the fact that it was in the thing.
So
we can half expect it.
Yeah, you don't let that be shown if it's not going to come out. But then also towards the end of the video showing an esports team playing on the Switch with a more professional, traditional Xbox-shaped controller, and they're playing a competitive version of Splatoon.
Yeah.
Setting up to, you know, also attract an esports-centric, esports fan demographic, which is a big part of the gaming populace now. And a lot of the messaging in this really, really was well done, I have to say, considering what we've come to expect from Nintendo, that they want to be a family-friendly game maker, that they want to appeal to grandmas and parents as much as kids and young kids and whatnot, but they're eschewing all that.
Yeah, it seems like part of the refocusing that's been happening throughout all of 2016 is part of that as well. Sort of similar to what happened with Xbox once
Phil Spencer took over.
Yeah, once Phil Spencer took over and they kind of dialed everything back. It seemed like, you know, every now and then when someone's in charge for too long, they try to make the system bigger than it should be or make their product do more than it should, it seems. And then it sort of makes it suffer as a result. I don't know. It's just sort of my opinion on this whole thing, but like we have a million media devices. There's Chromecasts, there's Rokus, there's like any plethora of Android boxes you can buy for your TV. We don't need another media center.
No,
we don't need another like family friendly entertainment device. If you're getting a gaming console, you want it for games. At least when I'm getting a gaming console, I want to play games on it.
It's true. And everything else of being, you know, the home media center that should be secondary. I mean, there are some aspects that should just be there by default, Netflix compatibility, that kind of stuff that you just expect now. And it's no longer a selling point of the machine.
Yeah.
But, you know, I'd imagine the Nintendo Switch will have, you know, the standard abilities, touch screen, like a tablet, Netflix, all everything you expect a normal tablet to have. Just it does this other stuff as well.
It's also a Nintendo Switch that has all of the games for the Nintendo Switch on it. There you go.
It's true. There's other, you know, stuff we could talk about with Legend of Zelda and its release date. Maybe there's a new Super Mario game coming out. Time will tell all about that, but
yeah, basically throughout the whole year, that was a bunch of good news.
And I'd also like to once again, reiterate that I really like the design, not only of the Switch, but the logo for the Switch.
Yes, it's a nice logo.
That is some good graphic design work. So that was just, kudos to whoever did that.
Yeah. I give them a pass on the bad names because they've always had bad names for things. The Wii's a terrible name. The Wiimote's a terrible name.
I like the Wii. I think it's, the Wii is a good name. It was a nothing name that Nintendo was able to define and then became synonymous with gaming.
Yeah, maybe Switch will be the same.
Maybe. It's possible. Although part of me still really like the NX. I like that. It's cool sounding to me.
It is cool sounding. It sort of brings us back to the N64 kind of days.
A little bit.
Because, you know, N64, even though that, it had a, that one was sort of the opposite, where it was supposed to be
the Ultra 64. The
Ultra 64, which is a cooler sounding name, but then it went backwards just to N64. I don't know. Whatever. But
another aspect, as we saw with the refocusing of Nintendo throughout the year, and as we said with Tatsumi Kimishima really putting his stamp on the company and trying to rein in the company's focus to be games and game machines and whatnot, announced earlier in the spring, but then finalized in August, in the dog days of summer, Nintendo announcing that they were selling, actually, their majority interest in the Seattle Mariners baseball team, along with Safeco Field, the home stadium of the Seattle Mariners, and Root Sports, a, American cable, sports cable outlet.
Yeah, now that's a long story, which we talked about back in August, which you can find on our website, thearcadeshow.com. So if you want way more details on that, we go into it there. But the long and the short of it is they were majority owners of the Seattle Mariners.
For 24 years.
And now they're not anymore.
No, they still have minority share, 10%, but here's the return on investment. They bought it in 92 for $100 million. They sold their interest in all that, the team, the stadium, the channel, $661 million.
Yeah, so over the 24 years, they made $500 million. Not an insignificant chunk of change. I wouldn't mind making an investment like that. If I could put in, $100 and get $500 back right away.
$5,000?
Yeah.
$500,000? Hell, take it. But ultimately, at a time when sales of the Wii U are little to nothing, sales of the 3DS somewhat slowing down, Nintendo needs an injection of cash flow. This was it. It's like selling another house that, you know, you were just kind of, you know, using as a rental property, but now you're selling it for good and you have a big influx of cash.
Yeah.
All at once. You're like, sweet, I can do a lot more with this now.
Yeah.
And that Nintendo needs that money ultimately to ramp up production of the Switch, also ramp up a massive marketing push for the Switch as well, as we are ahead of its release in March, because that is still the expected release window for the Nintendo Switch is March. What comes out with the Switch and in the release window, that remains to be seen, but certainly a year where Nintendo refocused their efforts. And all we really know that's going to be on the Switch from Nintendo is Legend of Zelda Breath of the Wild.
Yes, even though it's not going to be in the launch window.
That's true. That's,
or actually, I missed, sorry. It will be in the launch window, probably, of the Switch, but it won't be necessarily a launch title because it'll be coming out on the Wii U as well.
Mm-hmm.
Probably before that, maybe.
Although, actually, I was, the day that we are recording this on Thursday, January 5th, I was reading a Eurogamer report saying, oh, apparently Breath of the Wild might actually be back in the launch month of March for the Switch.
Okay.
Apparently, well, Nintendo over the new year, or end of December just kind of may have rethought things. That's going to be determined in the weeks ahead, but, Legend of Zelda's, at least surprising everybody and ultimately at the end of the year winning the most anticipated game award at the 2016 Game Awards. So take that for whatever it's worth, as it beat out, actually beat out some heavy hitters in the new God of War, Horizon Zero Dawn, Mass Effect Andromeda, and Red Dead Redemption 2.
Yes.
So Nintendo certainly had a good year to refocus. They've, you know, 2015, they took their wounds. 2016, they kind of put a plan in place. 2017 is now they have to put the rubber onto the road and make stuff happen.
Yes.
And we've seen that already with the first marketing message for the Switch, that initial video in October, showing the simple message of it's a device you can take with you and play at home. We'll see how they go forward ahead of its March release. But another big phenomenon that there was in the year of 2016 was certainly Pokemon Go.
Yeah, it came quick, it rode really hard, and then it burned out really fast.
There's many different, I guess, song lyrics you could apply to Pokemon Go to describe its release and popularity in North America. Better to burn out than to fade away. Here for a good time, not a long time, also comes to mind as well. Because Pokemon Go was a phenomenon, and god damn, did it ever burn hot and bright.
Yes.
But man, did it go quickly.
Yes, it was like, you know, fireworks.
Yeah.
I think is a pretty nice analogy.
But man, when it burned, there was a lot of, you know, quirky little stories that came out about of it as well. We first kind of got details about it when they were leaked during South by Southwest in March. In June, we kind of got a release window knowing it would be sometime in July. But what we did not know is that Niantic, the developers of Pokemon Go, and not Nintendo, they had little to nothing to do with it, would be rolling out Pokemon Go regionally.
Yeah.
Perhaps I had foolishly expected a, you know, just simultaneous worldwide release. Turns out they were rolling it out a little bit at a time, and the first places to get Pokemon Go were New Zealand, Australia, and the United States back on July 6th. Now, that's when it first became available for iOS and Android at the same time, and it took a couple days for that to just kind of get out and for people to really realize what it was, and it went viral. It was a viral app.
Yeah, it went, like, it was probably the must-have killer app for everyone's smartphones as soon as people knew about it.
Mm-hmm.
And as a result, Nintendo, despite the fact that, like, we'll keep saying over and over again that they had little to nothing to do with it,
mm-hmm.
Their stock prices actually went soaring for a little bit on July 11th, as a matter of fact. Just days after Pokemon Go was released in the States, their stock price rose over 30%, you know, adding $9 billion to the company's stock market value, mm-hmm. which is not insignificant.
No, that's quite a lot. And considering the stock price for Nintendo on the Tokyo Stock Exchange has really for the past couple of years just kind of gone down. This was a welcome jolt for the company, but is also why they had to use their professional communications staff to get ahead of this and say, look, we're somewhat profiting by virtue of our one-third ownership in the Pokemon brand, but we really don't have much to do with it.
Yeah, this was not an us endeavor.
No, so they're not reaping the full rewards of it, which is why they had to try and calm the hysteria over their stock before it took a huge crash. But there was a lot of little weird stories that came out about Pokemon Go within the first really week to 2 weeks of its release, because it took a while for people in America to get it, figure out what it was, play with it, and go from there. And also people in other parts of the world, like Canada, to, through various means, get it on their smartphone as well.
Until it was eventually officially released here. But I think the main categories of stories can sort of, we can sum them up into various categories of things that happened, because we saw them in the different categories. Well, these specific categories over and over again, the world over. One of the categories was businesses using Pokemon Go in some way to sort of attract more business.
Yes.
Another one of the categories was people going into inappropriate places and playing Pokemon Go. And, you know, it was essentially leading to kind of a lot of disrespectful behavior.
Yes.
And then another one of the categories was people trolling other people in various ways using Pokemon Go, basically either in an arms race or something. So I think, like, a good way to kind of illustrate this is, like, we can just talk about sort of, like, bigger stories for each of the categories and then just essentially say that similar things happen around the world.
Yes.
Also, there were some stories of people walking into traffic and not paying attention and doing things like that. But I guess that sort of happens. That's not really a Pokemon Go specific thing. We just kind of heard about it a lot more because the media likes to latch on to
a little bit, and it tied in because there was this big phenomenon and this person was playing Pokemon Go. Yes, well, they're also a stupid person.
Yeah, they probably would have done the same thing with Google Maps while driving or whatever.
Like, yeah.
It's any app that they're using. Like, people are known for not paying attention sometimes, but
it's called natural selection.
Yes, it sure is, but there was a New York pizza parlor whose business got boosted quite a bit when they essentially, they had a couple of Pokestops around their immediate vicinity, which is not uncommon for restaurants and things to have because I guess, like, that's just where the Pokestops are. They're sort of based on landmarks. But this one pizza parlor, Linizio Pizza, which is in Long Island, New York, they had the enterprising idea to just say, hey, let's spend some money, $10, and then bought a bunch of lures, and then they essentially just put lures on their Pokestops, which when a lure's on a Pokestop, it essentially gives you, I think it's a 3-hour window where it's essentially just like Pokemon City, like tons and tons of Pokemon will appear, and then people will kind of want to be in that vicinity to catch the Pokemon and reap the rewards. But if there's a pizza place right there as well, hey, why not get a slice and hang out?
And that's exactly what was happening. People would just come in, get a drink, get some pizza, a couple beers or whatever beverage was their choice. And in talking to the New York Daily News, one of the managers, Sean Benedetti of the Linizio Pizza Bar, told them that, yeah, this game, we've seen an increase of like 75% in their, you know, foot traffic of what they would normally get.
Yeah.
Which was kind of crazy. And we saw it, you know, used by many other places, restaurants, establishments, parks. I know even locally in Winnipeg, the Assiniboine Park Zoo had a Pokemon Day where they'd have a bunch of lures and whatever else. And ultimately, then you have people going around a zoo staring at their phones.
Yeah, not looking at the animals, not being at the zoo for the intended purpose. But whatever, it got people outside, I guess.
And through the gate and had to pay to get there. So be that as it may, but you also mentioned people trolling other people with Pokemon Go.
Yeah, I mean, while I'm sure some of us saw, you know, ludicrously overpowered Pokemon sitting at the top of gyms, making them essentially like impossible to take over, or ludicrously underpowered Pokemon just basically being there, being an F you to everyone else, being like, I took over this gym and this is the crappy Pokemon I'm going to put there. What you going to do about it? Like that was something that happened quite a bit, but I think the best trolling that happened was someone was doing, you know, the people's work against one of the worst religious extremist hate groups that exist, the Westboro Baptist Church. I think they're pretty much universally reviled.
I think by all corners, certainly even by people who share perhaps the same faith, they are reviled for bringing such a bad light to the faith and using it to do such hateful things.
Yeah. So, I mean, we're not going to get into what the Westboro Baptist Church is. All we're going to say is that they're jerks, basically.
Yep.
So the Westboro Baptist Church, one of their big things is basically being anti-gay people, anti-LGBT, mm-hmm. very, very much against them, with some offensive sentiment and, you know, really mean signs and stuff when they do protests. So what someone decided to do once they discovered that the Westboro Baptist Church was a gym location, was they took the gym over with a Clefairy named Love is Love. But not being one to back down from, you know, controversy or the limelight, the Westboro Baptist Church tried to reclaim the gym using a Jigglypuff. I don't know specifically what happened.
I don't think they were able to take it over. I think that was just they had announced that their intent was to reclaim it using a Jigglypuff, no doubt with some absurd name.
You know. They also had an absurd video that they posted on Twitter with, you know, the Jigglypuff song replaced with offensive hate lyrics as condoned by their quote unquote church.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, so that was maybe the biggest and best example of the big trolling that happened with Pokemon Go,
which was hilarious. But then we also saw what happens when people stare at their phones too often, and some places had Pokemon that maybe shouldn't have really had Pokemon, or people shouldn't have been catching them in these places. One of the best examples being both the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum and the Arlington National Cemetery in Arlington, Virginia, both had to release statements asking attendees and visitors to refrain from using their phones to catch Pokemon while they were there, because they're very somber, very sacred sites.
Yeah, they're not meant to be sort of like fun things. Like these are sort of like historical places just to sort of remind you of bad things that have happened. Just, you know, those that do not learn history are doomed mm-hmm. to repeat it.
And to honor those that perhaps have fallen in combat or
whatever,
what have you. Yes. As the statement, parts of the statement from the Arlington National Cemetery said, quote, we do not consider playing Pokemon Go to be appropriate decorum on the grounds of the ANC, end quote. The mere fact that statement had to be put out is kind of sad.
Yeah, it's kind of sad.
But that is the level of phenomena that people experience with Pokemon Go and the devotion to it, because, man, it captivated people hard.
Oh, yeah. But not for too long. By the end of the summer, or I'd say even maybe by the middle of summer, like maybe towards like August, it was sort of like the end days, really, where, you know, we saw the reports of Pokemon Go losing millions of daily active users.
Yet still having millions more.
I mean, there's still plenty of people that still play the game actively, I'm sure.
Mm-hmm.
But not to the point where it was for that first, like, you know, month or so, when it was just sort of burning hot and fast.
Exactly, where it was everywhere, where you, in any public place, any large gathering place, like a park or whatnot, you would see hordes of people gathering, staring at their phone.
Yep.
And I recall, as I would drive across the city of Winnipeg here, going through a part of the town, part of our city, at the base of a bridge, kind of backs onto a museum, here in Winnipeg, and around there, even no matter what time of night, if I'm going down, you know, 1, 2, 3 in the morning, what have you, I'd still see people in that area where it was a good Pokemon spot on their phones.
Yep.
Playing Pokemon Go. It was wild. But a game like this that requires individuals to be outside to play it and get the full experience of it certainly is limited in the amount of time it would be useful and popular.
Yeah.
I mean, once the weather gets colder, people aren't really wanting to go outside as much.
Yeah, maybe that's just a Winnipeg problem. I don't know how it's like for the rest of the world, but they didn't really keep adding features fast enough to the game to keep me interested anyways, but maybe I'm not the target demographic. I might be a little bit too old.
Perhaps, but also too, there was the fact that school came back into session.
Yeah.
And so the, some of the younger users, had to go to school, had to, you know, do homework, attend to their studies and whatnot, and perhaps would not have had the free time available to play like they did back in July and August. So that's understandable. That's natural. That's, there's nothing really Niantic, could do about that, but, you know, just really was surprising in just how far it reached. I mean, it got to the point where you would see it in stories on your local 6 o'clock news, the anchors joking about it and whatnot and asking each other if they've played it or whatnot and which Pokemon do they have. And
But there was even a case where it reached so high as one of the most powerful politicians in a country was caught, you know, in, you know, a government meeting, you know, someone looked over their shoulder and saw that they were playing. I guess there was a photo snapped of this person playing Pokemon Go during a government meeting. That person in specific, I should say, was Erna Solberg, who's the Norwegian prime minister.
Whoops.
Yeah. She was caught playing Pokemon Go during a debate in the Norwegian parliament.
But apparently this was actually common for Prime Minister Solberg, as earlier in the year during an official trip to Slovakia, she had taken some time out of her schedule and her meetings to just kind of go for a walk and told reporters that she was going to use the walk to hatch some of her 10-kilometer eggs, Pokemon eggs.
Yes. Which on the one hand is ridiculous, but on the other hand, meh. Okay.
It's harmless.
I mean, it's harmless. It's kind of amusing, mm-hmm. but yeah.
And the funny thing is too, at the time when, Prime Minister Solberg of Norway was photographed in Parliament playing Pokemon Go when someone else was talking, that someone else who was talking was a member of the, Norwegian opposition party who had previously been photographed in Parliament playing Pokemon Go.
Yes. So this wasn't, you know, an isolated incident with just one person even.
No. There was some element of commonality to this, and I believe even in talking to the press after about the fact that she had been photographed in Parliament playing Pokemon Go, Prime Minister Solberg said, well, you know, at least the other person who was talking while she was photographed playing, you know, she said, well, she can appreciate it. You know, she understands.
Yeah, she gets it.
Yeah. But as hot and fast as Pokemon, you know, Go burned on smartphones, it certainly couldn't last at that rate, at that ferocious adoption rate and the rate at which people were playing it, spending that much time playing it as well. Nothing can ever last like that.
No.
But, so that was smartphone games. And now let's move and talk about home consoles and the other major game companies, Sony, Microsoft. They were out there still in the world as well, and I think it's safe to say that 2016 was the year that both the PlayStation 4 and Xbox One had a midlife crisis.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it.
And so they did what all, like, old dads in a midlife crisis do. They went and got sports cars.
Yes, which is, in console terms, just to essentially go back and retool themselves and come out with new versions.
With more power.
With more power, oh, but also...
This one goes faster.
Yeah, this one goes faster, but still has to be able to play can't play new games on it because it still has to be compatible with the old version.
Yeah. You know, meaning, well, it still has to, you know, fit in the old garage, but, you know, goes faster.
Yeah.
So the reports of Sony working on a new, more powerful PlayStation, PlayStation 4 started to come out at the end of March, and it was the middle of April, actually, when the tech specs for it had been leaked, and at that time it was kind of impressive, but, you know, there was details in there, you know, that Sony had stipulated that, the PlayStation 4, Neo at the time as it was known, and being referred to because there was no other code name for it.
And we all know that Sony likes to use names from the Matrix as their code names.
This is true. That, you know, it would still be in this current ecosphere of PlayStation games. There wouldn't be specific unique features to it, which was weird. And then in June, just a week before E3, Andrew House, the president and CEO of Sony, was talking to the Financial Times and said that, well, he did two kind of surprising things. One, he casually confirmed that, yeah, they're working on a new, more powerful PlayStation 4, but said it's not going to be at E3, when we kind of expected it would be at E3.
Yeah.
Because that's the time you show off hardware.
Yep.
E3. Did I miss something? But that was not the case. And instead, during E3, Microsoft kind of seized on that opening and figured, well, if Sony's not going to be showing stuff off, so we'll show off our platforms, our new consoles. And so they started their stage presentation at E3 by showing off the new, slimmer, yet still kind of more powerful Xbox One, now known as the Xbox One S.
Yeah.
For slim, but they don't call it slim. S. Sounds more, you know, classy that way.
Yes. Sleek.
Yes. Sleek. Slim. Slender. Svelte. I mean, the Xbox One S, it is also has some new features. It includes support for 4K video and high dynamic range, or HDR, which we will talk more about because that's one of the buzz terms that came out with, it was attached to these new consoles. And then at the end of their stage presentation at E3, Microsoft confirmed what had been rumored and referred to as Project Scorpio, referring to it actually as Project Scorpio. We just thought that was kind of a, you know, code name and Microsoft would reveal something snazzier. No, they're still calling it the code name, but for now,
yeah.
saying that it will still be part of this Xbox One ecosystem, but it's more powerful, saying that it features 8 cores, 320 gigs of memory bandwidth, and the all-important 6 teraflops of game of processing power.
All important, yes.
6 teraflops. Man, they really made a point of stressing that 6 teraflops.
They sure did.
Because that's a new metric that performance is measured by. It's the only metric. Now, if you don't know much about teraflops, then it's just kind of lost on you. But also know there are current graphic cards on the market where that have better teraflop performance.
Yeah. Well, that's always been the case, though, and that will always be the case,
mm-hmm.
that the PC, well, side of things will always be further ahead than the console side of things.
Yes.
That's never not going to be the case.
And Microsoft and Phil Spencer are saying that the 6 teraflops of performance is really going to allow for uncompressed 4K gaming.
Yes.
Sure.
But the one thing with Project Scorpio and also PS4 Neo, which was later revealed with its real name to be called Pro, was that developers can't make games that are exclusive for Project Scorpio or Pro.
No.
They have to be compatible with the Slim and S, as well as the original versions of the PlayStation 4 and Xbox One.
Mm-hmm.
They can't be specific versions, like they can maybe just have enhanced features, but the games have to be the same.
Yes, they absolutely do. And they can't have console specific features either.
No, like when I say enhanced features, like maybe better frame rate, maybe slightly enhanced textures.
Mm-hmm.
The gameplay has to be the same.
Exact same.
Yes, because if you're playing an online version of, let's say, a Call of Duty game or something with, you know, you have you know, Project Scorpio and you're playing with your friend who has an Xbox One, you still have to be able to play the game with each other. It can't be a different game. That's the whole idea, which is a relief if you're a console owner and you do have a previous version of the console, but it also kind of sucks if you're a developer because, well, okay, you're sort of kneecapping us, I guess, but that's the whole interesting, thing that happened with, I think that was the big takeaway that happened for both companies as, company specific things go.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so.
It's, I mean, the PlayStation 4 Pro is out now. The Xbox One S is currently available. Project Scorpio, we believe will come out in 2017, later in 2017 around traditional console release time, you know, fall of 2017.
Yeah.
Is when that usually is. But this is a mid-gen console upgrade refresh that.
Yeah, I mean, it's not uncommon for them to release a second version that is made maybe cheaper,
mm-hmm.
that they've improved on the design, that is the same console that maybe might just have like a slimmer form factor or what have
you. Yeah, some other cosmetic or aesthetic, you know, upgrades. That's fine. That's common actually in basically every console cycle.
Yeah, every single console I think I can think of, going even back to the Super Nintendo or even the NES.
NES did too.
Like they all have done it.
Because the NES towards the end got
they had became, the top loader.
Yeah, one. Became the weird top loading thing to match the design of the Super Nintendo. Yet we haven't really seen until now these console refreshes getting improved guts.
No.
That are and aren't taken advantage of.
Yeah, or that can and can't be taken advantage of.
Which, this is an interesting proposition that is being put forward. It's also specifically in the case of the PlayStation 4, which it's put out there, you know, for 4K gaming, high dynamic range. If you have a 4K TV, it's going to look stupendous. But it really depends on what your display is as well.
Yeah.
With the PlayStation 4 Pro, it has the functionality where it can detect what your display is and then set things appropriately to try and make things look the best. But then how do you really test the or show what the PlayStation 4 Pro can do and what graphics it can present if it's kind of display specific?
But also, how can you do that if you have to make sure that you're making the same games? If you're making a game that has to be compatible with every version of the system, like you can't make a game that's just fundamentally way graphically superior.
No, nope.
That wouldn't be feasible.
Certainly not.
So it's a very weird position that I think Sony and Microsoft have sort of put both developers and the public in.
It is. And as a consumer, I'm left kind of wondering what is really the proposition. What's the selling point of these new machines other than they just make things look better?
Yeah. For me, the selling point was, oh, I got the Slim for cheaper now. It's like, okay, you released two new versions and the cheaper one is cheaper than the old one. Well, I'm going to get that cheaper one then. And that's what I did.
Mm-hmm. If there's no fundamental difference, really, it'll look better. Okay. That's great. But we're in a point now where every system will make games look good.
Yeah.
That's the technology. It's universal. Everything will look good now. And if it doesn't, someone has failed miserably. But
yeah. So for me, I mean, I don't really do PC gaming too much because of, I don't like the arms race aspect.
Mm-hmm.
And it sort of initially worried me that the console ecosystem was going to become an arms race as well, similar to the PC ecosystem. I was relieved that it wasn't, but it also kind of confused me that what's the point?
Exactly.
So
I understand, but from, you know, the Sony Microsoft perspective, you still want to have these systems compatible with what you've just released because you've just released them. These systems are 2 to 3 years old at the most, and you can't really move on. It's seemingly too early to move on to a whole new console generation.
Yeah.
And leave these current gamers behind who have just spent hundreds of dollars investing in your machines and still want support for it. I'm still concerned by some of the quotes and interviews we heard from Sony and Microsoft executives trying to draw parallels between the console cycle now, or now in future console cycles, and mobile phones. And saying that every couple of years, people upgrade their mobile phone and do a refresh of that and whatnot. And, it's got, it may fundamentally be the same. It's just got improved, guts and performance and whatnot. But the big difference is people usually aren't buying the full price or paying the full price for their smartphone.
No, their smartphone's cost is subsidized when they're getting a plan.
Yes.
Like you're never going to be spending a full, $1,600 or whatever, like the latest iPhone was,
mm-hmm.
when you're buying it off contract without a plan. No, you're going to be getting the $100-ish version of the phone, whatever it is, maybe $300
you're
spending on it with a plan. But that's the thing, like, you get one and you need the other. So it's like a symbiotic weird relationship that helps sort of subsidize both sides of things.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't exist for the consoles. I mean, yeah, maybe you could do some weird thing tying into PlayStation Plus or Xbox Live, but
companies haven't done that. They haven't announced that.
No, they haven't. And also those memberships aren't as expensive as a cell phone contract.
No, they are not.
So it's hard to draw parallels with that, despite what they're trying to do. But either way, that was the big thrust of news from Sony and Microsoft.
It was a confusing time and a confusing year for them, and can't help but also wonder, well, we get some of the motivation as to why they're going for this mid-gen console upgrade. I mean, 4K TVs are, now out there, they're starting to be adopted, but a lot of people still just have their, regular HD TVs with 1080p. 4K isn't really being massively adopted yet, and people aren't making the change quite yet.
No.
Perhaps even in the numbers that they were previously. But, I mean, they're still expensive.
Yeah, and they're still expensive, and the jump is not worth the justification.
No, and also if you just spent, $1,000, $2,000, $3,000, $4,000 on this HD TV that looks great a couple years ago, there's no real reason to, because there isn't a plethora, there isn't a dearth of 4K content.
No, not yet.
And granted, these systems can also handle high dynamic range. Well, that just, is more to do with the colors represented on screen and contrast and whatnot. Great. So it looks prettier. That's the main thrust of it. Actually, even at CES this week, a couple companies were showing off 8K TVs. Yeah.
Yes.
So
in 10 years, when you need a new TV, from this point on, if you haven't, or if you're not satisfied with your TV, I don't know. For me, that would be the next jump in 10 years. Like if my current TV dies sometime,
mm-hmm.
maybe if that technology is available, I might get an 8K TV, but I'm 5 years into a 1080p HD TV and it looks great still.
And for a lot of people, that's also the thought process as well. Well, why change? Well, if you're not changing to a 4K TV, you're not really getting the full benefit of these new consoles.
Yes.
So that's one of the reasons and one of the motivations to try and sell people is, well, no doubt, especially for Sony, to try and sell more 4K TVs. But also, too, because there's the younger, sexier technology on the horizon that's coming up and nipping at their heels, and that is virtual reality.
Yes, and that's another thing that Sony actually positioned themselves really well with that as well. I mean, if we can go back for just 1 second.
We can.
Just to kind of talk, just to say something that, well, Sony did really well in the past year, which I think they put a leg up on Microsoft a little bit with, was their VR. The PlayStation VR was, well, it's cheaper and it's, I would say it's a better implementation of VR than a lot of the other implementations of VR out there.
Certainly, and I think a lot of that has to do with the source of the computing power for the PlayStation VR.
Yeah.
The fact that it ties into the PlayStation 4, and I'm sure that's one of the reasons for the PlayStation 4 Pro, so it can do VR better and represent the graphics, the frame rate and whatnot better to compete with an Oculus Rift, HTC Vive, the other main headsets out there.
Yeah. Having said that, though, I mean, we both had a hands-on experience with PlayStation VR with a regular PlayStation 4, not a PlayStation 4 Pro.
Nope.
And it was great.
That's true. when you have the headset on, it's more about the immersion than the graphics, really.
Yeah. So,
I mean, the graphics are a, you know, pathway to the immersion experience, but it's also, you know, what you're feeling, what you're hearing, and that kind of sensory experience.
Yes. But regardless, 2016 was the year that VR, I feel, properly arrived as a viable thing that is now in people's headspace.
It is here. It's not going away anytime soon, given the major companies that are involved. And we entered in 2016 knowing about Oculus and the fact they were working on the Oculus Rift. We knew about HTC and Valve partnering together for something called the HTC Vive. Both of those ultimately came out within about a week of each other, actually. At the end of March is when the Oculus Rift finally came out to, initially to backers and then later, you know, available to ship to all customers. And then at the start of April, HTC released the HTC Vive. So the two major VR headsets right now came out very soon after each other with major backing behind both of them. Yet this is also the year we saw other companies get involved in VR. We knew Sony was working on Project Morpheus, which then became PlayStation VR, and that came out in the year of 2016 as well. But this was also the year that we saw other technology companies get involved. In March, AMD announced that they were going to get into the headset market by announcing the something called the Sulon Q, which was a headset, a VR headset they were developing in a partnership with Sulon Technologies. And as part of their announcement, AMD announced that the Sulon Q would be the first and only, quote, all-in-one, tether-free, wear-and-play, spatially aware headset for virtual reality and augmented reality. However, it's still not hit the market. They're still working on it.
Yeah. Also in August, Intel announced that they were coming out with their own VR headset, which was called Project Alloy, or which they were deeming Project, well, the name of its Project Alloy. I'm sure that's not the final name.
No.
That's
the working title.
The working title, the project name.
Yes. So these are other large technology companies getting involved in the virtual reality space as well.
Yeah, and it hasn't quite reached the point that those micro consoles had reached, you know, where everyone and their dog released one, you know, after the success of the Ouya. Mm-hmm. But maybe 2017 we'll see that starting to happen.
Potentially. I wonder if it will get to that point, though, given that the barrier for technological entry is much higher.
Yeah, there's a base level of technology that's required to run an effective VR headset. Mm-hmm. And I don't know how cheap you can make it. I don't know how, like, what, you know, an average company off the street can just do to make their own version of it.
Yeah.
It's hard to say. With a micro console, anyone and their dog can just rip a cell phone apart and just, or, you know, grab like a Raspberry Pi kind of machine and just toss something together. That's easy. Technology exists everywhere. But yeah, it's hard to say who else is going to get into this market yet, but the doors are open now as in terms of like what the public will pay money for.
That's still a good question because the price point on these devices are for the most part quite high. You're paying around $800, $900 US for the Oculus Rift and HTC Vive. PlayStation 4 has a lower price point, but you also need the PlayStation 4 console. PSVR has the lower price point, but you need the console as well to run it. And that's the other thing too. The price points for these headsets, the VR headsets, they're high. Then you need a pretty gutsy PC to run them as well.
Yeah, that's definitely true.
And that's going to cost you $1,500, $2,000 at least.
Plus all the different headsets, whether or not you're getting an HTC Vive or an Oculus or whatever.
Mm-hmm. And, but this is also the year we saw other people, not just technologies, kind of latch on, and give some validation to VR as being a new it hip technology that we'll see about its staying power. That's something only time can determine, but.
Yeah, game and software companies deciding to kind of try to make experiences, from everyone from Ubisoft, to IKEA.
Yes. Yes.
Coming up with a very interesting app, idea, in my opinion. That one's probably worth talking about.
It certainly is, because that happened back in April when they released an app for the HTC Vive on Steam.
Yeah, they had released this thing called, well, they were calling it their pilot virtual reality app, which implies that more things are yet to come from IKEA, which I wouldn't doubt.
Mm-hmm.
But they made an experience where you can walk around and interact with a virtual kitchen, you know, with, interacting with things just like you were there. And you can change the look of kitchen by switching materials, or I'm sure changing different cabinet styles or whatever, all essentially just being a big ad for shopping for an IKEA kitchen, which is fine, but that's a great idea.
That's actually a good use of the technology.
That's a fantastic use of the technology. Who wouldn't want to just essentially take a 3D model of a room that they have and then just essentially grab things virtually from IKEA just to see how they visually fit in with things that mm-hmm. they have.
As opposed to standing in this, the aisles of IKEA trying to, in your mind's eye, picture how this cupboard would look over there, this color of countertop, what have you.
It's like, do these plates even, like, does this cutlery seem like it's the right style or whatever? Like, mm-hmm. all things like that. VR is a great use, like, it's a great idea for that.
It certainly can be, yeah. And IKEA was the first company we saw using it for that as well. And yet, in 2016 also, was the only company we saw doing that. No one had, or nobody quickly copied IKEA's game plan to release, that sort of visualization app for your space. Though I'd imagine we'll see other people do that in 2017. I think we'll also see IKEA come out with, another VR app as well, likely multi-platform. But 2016 was also the year we saw, for some reason, the Six Flags theme park company announce that they were going to alter their roller coasters and make some of them now VR coasters.
Yeah, which I had a big rant, and I'm not going to revisit it. You could, again, go through the archives on our website, thearcadeshow.com.
Or find past episodes on iTunes or our space on the Google Play podcast market. Links to those directly on our website, thearcadeshow.com.
But yeah, basically they were not necessarily positive comments and more confused comments about what's the point. VR is just sort of like meant to just be sort of a home type technology that lets you expand your home into something more big
mm-hmm.
rather than if you have a roller coaster, you're making it smaller than it actually is by strapping a VR headset onto your head. In my opinion, I might be wrong, but.
Well, also the question has to be asked too, are these coasters not exciting enough?
That's the thing. It's like, I mean, typically if you're riding a roller coaster, it's going to be a big, crazy, shocking, fast experience.
Mm-hmm.
How is closing your face off and your main sensory input for that being your eyes? How is closing your eyes off from what's actually happening supposed to make it better in any way?
That's a good question. Still don't have an answer. There were two experiences that Six Flags announced, one being called the New Revolution, which would be kind of an aerial dogfight type experience. The other being a Superman themed one where you would watch and perhaps experience as Superman would fight, Lex Luthor and his minion of robots and whatnot. And I don't care what anyone says, motion sickness would have to be a huge factor for these things.
Oh, probably. But yeah. Either way, those are probably the biggest two non-game experiences. But then there weren't too many game type experiences that we heard about either. But what we did hear about were kind of either interesting or maybe a little bit shocking in how small of scope they might have been.
Mm-hmm.
The biggest one being the Batman Arkham VR title, which, when the news came out that the experience itself was only going to be roughly an hour long, on the outside of an hour, give or take, a few minutes kind of thing, our initial thoughts were, will that be enough? Is that like enough of an experience? Can you justify?
Is that satisfying?
But then Then after trying VR for a bit myself, I can say maybe it would be.
Well, certainly VR headsets are not meant to be a prolonged experience.
No, I don't think so. Yeah. I couldn't picture myself playing Final Fantasy 15 or some long...
Skyrim.
Yeah, or a Skyrim-type game. I couldn't picture myself spending hundreds of hours in a VR headset.
There would have to be some sort of effect on you physically, disorientation as soon as you take the headset off, motion sickness, or, you know, you just become addicted. And you don't want to live in a world outside of the VR headset.
Yes.
I'm kind of picturing, you know, that game on that one episode of Star Trek Next Generation.
Yes. Everyone always
the weird headset disc game where everyone just became addicted to it.
Yes. Or the very good novel Ready Player One, which I could recommend if you've never read it. If you're a video gamer and you I've been meaning to read something, read Ready Player One. It's an easy read.
Fair enough. I believe there's also a film version in the works from Steven Spielberg.
That's correct.
Indeed. One of the only notable big game experiences or game announcements for VR that came out in 2016 alongside Batman Arkham VR coming out was actually Ubisoft announcing that they were going to be working on a Star Trek experience, a Star Trek VR game called Star Trek Bridge Crew, which they announced just ahead of E3. And this one was kind of unique because you would get to actually be in a first-person perspective on the bridge of a Federation starship.
Yeah, and the big ad, well, not the ad, but the sizzle video that they had of celebrities showing this off was LeVar Burton with a few other former Star Trek actors and actresses.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of fleshing out the crew. I think they had Jerry Ryan in there, and I think they had
Carl Urban, actually, who played Bones in the new movies.
Yeah, but a couple of people just kind of showing off, you know, playing their typical characters at their own posts, you know, Geordi at engineering kind of thing. And LeVar Burton being the only one who could actually keep the Star Trek lingo up properly, which was impressive considering he hasn't been on the show for that for a number of years now, but all the actors are like, wow, just kind of in awe of his technobabble mastery, which is a sign that he's actually a fan of Star Trek. but yeah, that was very interesting experience that I look forward to playing at some point.
Mm-hmm. That one is slated for release on March 14th of this year, was supposed to come out at the, in the latter months of 2016. Didn't happen, was ultimately delayed to 2017. But with Star Trek Bridge Crew, and to get a full immersive multiplayer experience, it runs into the problem, which we've mentioned earlier, of VR games, and that's the barrier being price point.
Yeah, price point, number of headsets available. Like, if you play it on PlayStation VR, you'll need one PlayStation per headset.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're playing it with four people, that becomes a very pricey endeavor. Not as pricey as if you're playing it on PC, which we again talked about. And I think we ended up estimating it out to be something, what, like
$10,000
just to play it with four people.
Yep.
So,
which in the sizzle video, they show four people, you know, three of them being Star Trek actors, playing the game.
Yes.
Which, good for them. Ubisoft's putting it on. They can supply the technology. The home user sure as hell can't, because who has $10,000? We'll see if there's any notable price drops in VR in 2017, because it's going to take some significant price drops to really drive mass adoption of the technology.
Yeah, but
speaking of mass adoption.
Speaking of mass adoption and price drops and whatnot, or just another thing in general, maybe the
hype trains.
The last big newsmaker of 2016, again, for better or for worse, in this case, mostly worse.
A lot of worse.
Was No Man's Sky.
Indeed, and that was, it did not have a good year. Well, didn't have a good last half of the year.
No, everything before the game was released was great. Way better than any indie developer could have ever possibly hoped for. When the game was released, it all went downhill from there.
Quickly, too.
And Hello Games quickly realized the importance of a professional PR person.
Yeah, I think what a lot of people need to keep in mind, even still now when talking about No Man's Sky and its developer Hello Games, is that
it's an indie game.
They're 20 people or less.
Yes.
In their studio.
They're a very small studio. They made an indie game. Indie games traditionally, a lot of them are great. Mm-hmm. There's lots of great indie games out there. I'm not disparaging indie games.
Stardew Valley was an indie hit in 2016, Inside, from Limbo, Games. So yeah, I mean, name two off the top of my head.
Yeah, there's lots of good indie games. Indie games can be big. Indie games can be rich experiences. Indie games can compete with AAA experiences.
Mm-hmm.
But they're not AAA games because they don't have the budget, they don't have the manpower, they don't have all of the resources that a Ubisoft, a Square Enix,
Activision. Sony,
and Activision has to them to make a AAA experience. Indie games typically have a scope that's way dialed down. Indie games, when they get released, there's usually an understanding that the game might change over the course of the game's life. Minecraft is a perfect example of this. Mm-hmm. The Minecraft that was released when it was first released is not the Minecraft that you know now.
No.
There was many, many iterations on Minecraft after it was released. The game, like, there, indie games get patched all the time.
Mm-hmm.
That's something that if you're spending an indie game price on an indie game, you're sort of half expecting that to happen. Like, okay, I'm going to buy this game. It's made by a small developer. It might not be perfect, but I'll give it that for what it's worth. If that's how No Man's Sky's release was handled, people would not be in the same position that they are now.
There would not be the vitriol for Hello Games and Sean Murray as what we saw upon the game's release.
Yes.
A lot of it has to do with the communication and the messaging of the game. And I'm gonna, putting together this show and reading some more of the, or rereading some of the stories about No Man's Sky and whatever else, the thought occurred to my head, that I think there is some responsibility that Sony has to bear for Absolutely. This as well.
Absolutely.
And they have skated by.
Yes, Sony kind of threw Hello Games a little bit under the bus.
They did. They absolutely did. Hold on here.
So what happened in my mind when I look back on it was Sony was like Willy Wonka. They gave Charlie Bucket the golden ticket to go through, you know, the Wonka factory.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, they gave Hello Games a lot of time on a AAA stage to show off a crazy game, to show off this, you know, obviously scripted sizzle reel of, mm-hmm. What this game will be.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm using will very liberally here. And it blew people's minds. Essentially, it was a really great indie game idea, but people were under the impression that it was going to be this fully formed, full universe, crazy multiplayer experience.
Because it looked like that. Like, yes, it would come from a major studio. And Sony didn't really do anything to quell that notion at all. Sony, in both 2014 and 2015, had No Man's Sky as part of their E3 experience.
Yeah.
In 2014, it was just a little video. 2015, they had Sean Murray on stage actually doing a gameplay demo of what No Man's Sky would be like. You know, going through in this spaceship, some space combat onto the planet, exploring the planet, and then flying back out from the planet to really get people's, you know, salivating over the game and kick the hype train into overdrive.
Yeah.
Yet Sony did nothing to try and quell that notion that it's not a major AAA title, that it's being developed by a small studio, did not message that at all, just said that they were excited and looking forward to it and yada, yada, yada. And yet upon its release, were very quiet.
Yes.
And then it was in September when actually Shuhei Yoshida, who's an executive at PlayStation, was speaking with Eurogamer, and he was commenting on the strategy that Sean Murray and Hello Games took to discuss features, and some of the features that didn't make it into No Man's Sky right away. And man, he was quite okay to chastise them.
Yeah. He said specifically, I understand some of the criticisms, especially Sean Murray is getting, because he sounded like he was promising more features in the game from day one. It wasn't a great PR strategy.
Yeah, that's the full quote of what he, you know, told Eurogamer about the respect. Here's the thing. Sony, as a major international company, has a huge communication staff.
Yeah.
They know full well Hello Games is small. A dozen people. Maybe 15 people.
Like, there are things that they could have done to sort of add a little bit of a buffer and manage expectations on Hello Games' behalf. I feel things they should have done if they were giving this small company this big of an avenue.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's a huge, like, it's a huge opportunity for Hello Games, certainly.
Oh, yeah.
But I feel like it's essentially like letting the little kid into the fire truck. Like, it's like, yeah, you're not going to let him drive the truck. You're going to let him honk the horn or, you know, turn the siren on a bit. You have to kind of like ease them into that position. Like there's mistakes will be made, sure, but you can't just let them fall from the top of a skyscraper like that, right from the top.
Certainly not. And you'd think Sony could offer up some of their PR staff, say, hey, work with these guys, or be like, you know, don't worry. We'll handle your messaging or their problems. We'll work to get it out there deal directly with the public.
They could have said things like, it's like a highly anticipated indie title.
Mm-hmm.
You know, from a small team comes something that seems big. You know, like there's things that they could have done to, you know, plant the seed a little bit better in people's minds that this is a small team putting this together.
And also too, the mere fact that Sony had Hello Games and No Man's Sky for two consecutive years at their E3 show.
Yeah.
That is a presence that Last Guardian didn't have, God of War didn't have, Final Fantasy 15 didn't have. A lot of these recent AAA titles did not appear in consecutive years at Sony's E3 show.
No.
No Man's Sky did. That's a very prominent position that they were put in by Sony, and Sony had full expectations that, you know, Hello Games would deliver. But they also should have known better that they're a small studio who are kind of punching above their weight class.
Yeah. Now, having said that, you know, you could, in hindsight, it looks like all of the things that Sean Murray was doing on Twitter and, you know, whatever other avenues of social media and whatnot, he was really kind of trying to manage expectations the best he knew,
mm-hmm.
which is, you could tell that he wasn't prepared for that level of just people.
He's a developer.
Yeah, he's a developer. He's a creative person. He's not, you know, a PR master. So, you know, he was, in hindsight, a lot of the things he was saying looked like they were things that he wanted maybe the game to be.
Mm-hmm.
Like, yeah, that would be cool. It's just like, oh yeah, don't worry, we got things planned. But it's just like,
I think what also didn't help at all was the fact that upon the game's release and people getting it and finding whatever issues they found in the game, bugs, absent features that they expected there to be, was the silence from the company.
Yeah.
Most notably when pretty soon after the game's release, those two players found each other or went to the same spot, same universe, same time, same location, expecting to interact with each other.
Yeah, because one of the things that sort of was heavily hinted at, if not promised by Hello Games, was the fact that, you know, you would be able to encounter other players in the universe. Now, that was never clarified whether or not that meant, like, you could encounter the mark of other players in mm-hmm. the universe, whether or not you could just see worlds claimed by other people or whatever. Or if that actually meant real time, hi, you can see my ship, I can see your ship, let's have a space battle.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that was never confirmed, but I guess a lot of people thought the latter. And no, you know, surprisingly enough, despite how huge the universe actually is, because it's enormous, it's trillions of kilometers big.
Like, mm-hmm.
they have something like, you know, however many exoplanets, like however many exo some huge number that's like bigger. The name of the denomination is too big for me to remember right now. But the two people managed to realize that, hey, we're in the exact same space in the universe. And then they basically were both Twitch streaming it at the time. Sean Murray essentially acknowledged, wow, that's amazing.
Didn't think that would happen.
Didn't think that was going to happen at all, let alone on the first day kind of thing.
And never addressed why the players were not actually seeing each other, encountering each other at all. And I think at the time he just tried to chalk it up to server overload or something because there were so many people playing it or whatever the case may have been, but didn't really offer a definitive specific reason as to why.
No. And then never cleared that up at all.
Nope. So we still don't really know if there's official multiplayer in the game or, you know, that being one of the features, or will you ever be able to encounter other players in this shared universe? Because it is a shared universe.
Yeah. It's, but is it shared in so far as everyone gets the same landmark information about planets, about, you know, ships discovered, about ores mined or whatever?
Mm-hmm.
Or is it shared insofar as everyone gets to see each other?
That's a question that's not yet been answered.
It sounds more like it's the previous and not the latter, where everyone has their own instance of the universe with shared information about the universe,
mm-hmm.
rather than a shared universe
where everyone's in, you know, can go see each other.
Yeah, like a World of Warcraft or something. But it doesn't sound like that's the case.
Maybe that will come one day in later updates.
Yes, but as we said, this is a indie game, and indie games do get updates.
It's true, and the first real big one came out at the end of November, called the Foundation Update, which basically Hello Games set to work on soon as the game launched. And that's, I'm sure, likely why they were quiet as well, which worked to fix a whole bunch of the, you know, bugs and problems that people experience, but also brought in a new dynamic of base building to the game as well to try and make something more interesting for people to do. One of the big complaints people had with No Man's Sky, and we'll see how that's addressed in future updates, is that it's actually kind of boring. You get tired of just being solitary in space, hopping around.
Yeah.
Pretty quickly. Hence, you know, why people want to find others and interact with them in some way, shape, or form.
Yes.
But
I read something, actually, someone saying, it was a more recent think piece on No Man's Sky, about how they're defending it, saying they liked it, but they were admitting that it's actually, it's a trillion miles wide, but only a few inches deep. Which is probably a great way to put it.
Yeah.
I mean, it doesn't, the gameplay is not very deep. The exploration can be, it's not even really that deep, it's just that there's a lot of it.
Yeah.
So that might be your thing, that might not be your thing, but that's what ended up being a thing. And
I'm sure there will be more large updates for No Man's Sky in the year 2017.
Yeah, but the big lesson from them is, if you are in that position, hire a PR firm, get together with proper PR people, figure out what you can and can't say, should and shouldn't say,
mm-hmm.
how to properly manage public expectations, talk to people. Like, if you're going to be on the Sony stage, you should have a real plan. And you should be able to, you know, figure out how to gently let people down when they ask you the moon.
Mm-hmm.
That's, I think, the biggest thing that we learned in 2016 about the dangers of running or being in that situation.
Certainly. And I can't help but think of the creator of Stardew Valley. When we speak of No Man's Sky and the PR strategy or lack of PR strategy for the game, given that Hello Games basically just kind of floundered without one and tried to speak for themselves but didn't really work out because
they were half promising fake things. They were half like scrambling to come up with excuses. And not just being honest with people.
And also just clamming up and not saying anything at all and not providing any sort of accessibility or transparency. And yet the creator of Stardew Valley, was everything. He was the PR guy, developer, programmer, architect, producer, director of the game. Also being tech support. I read, stuff on, I believe Kotaku and a couple other game news sites where after the release, people were interacting with him over Twitter, Facebook, what have you, and just, pointing out bugs they may have found to him, and he'd graciously accept the feedback and just say, okay, well, that's, something I'll have to work on tomorrow. It's been a 14-hour day already. And it was really just a one-man game, Stardew Valley.
Yep.
But that was kind of a known fact that it was just this one guy making his homage to Harvest Moon and whatnot. And people accepted that because it was communicated from the outset.
Yeah, he had a clear strategy of what he was going to be doing and how he wanted to interact with his fans and everything.
And made it clear he was the one talking the whole time and everything was him.
Yeah.
So it is possible if you're an indie developer to have to do PR yourself, you just have to a plan.
It's really all about having a plan and managing expectations.
Yes.
If you let your expectations, if you let the public expectations get out of your hands, you're screwed. You're in Hello Games' situation.
Mm-hmm. If there's a vacuum, a void of information, people will fill that with their own imaginations, own expectations. And that's a problem. Then you're having to work back from that. And that's not a good thing.
No, it's not.
Because people will feel disappointed. So if you're out there, if you're a small studio and you're listening to our show, thank you. And also learn from Hello Games. Just communicate as much as you can, regularly with your audience about what they can expect, what you're working on, what's coming next, problems, accomplishments, everything.
Yes.
And people will be receptive to it.
Yep.
This is what we've learned in 2016. There's been a lot we've learned in 2016 as well, but those were just some of the big points of what we saw from the past 12 months, the big stories that we felt and big topics that we felt were big enough to put on part one of our 2016 year in review. We will have part two for you next week on the arcade when we focus on the smaller yet worthwhile to mention stories from 2016 as well. Some good, some bad, some funny, some ludicrous.
Yes.
Of the year 2016. And that will, next week's show will put a nice little bow tie on 2016 for us. And then we'll move on to 2017 and what it holds for us in 2 weeks hence. But as I said, next week, part two of 2016 year in review. We thank you so much for joining us, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, children of all ages, and want to hear from you. What were your big stories of 2016? What do you think we should have also covered on this week's show? We want to hear from you. Email us info@thearcadeshow.com. Leave us a message. Follow us on Twitter @TheArcadeShow and on Facebook, facebook.com/TheArcadeShow. And as we've said, you can find full episodes of the stories where we went more in depth on all these big topics throughout the year of 2016 on our website in the archives, thearcadeshow.com, on our iTunes page and our Google Play podcast section page. We have links to those right there on our website, thearcadeshow.com. So until next week for part two of the year in review, good night, everybody.
Good night.